Brad Sesmat Show, broadcasting live.
It's a good Tuesday. Thanks for being with us. Jordan Spurgeon from our team at 10:20 today. Last night, we released a documentary, From ALS to Ashes, and Spurge worked on it, was the executive producer on it. Corey Noctis story. Brandy Aguilar was with him. So I want to go through the process of this documentary. It was well viewed last night on our YouTube page and our YouTube channel, I should say. And it's on our homepage of the website, sports360az.com. It will also be on Bally Sports Arizona, airing this entire week in the Football AZ show. There's a lot of layers to it. And I think if you're into the process of media and documenting and being in the process of it all, hearing from Spurge will be good for you. That comes up at 10:20. Bob Herrig. Been trying to get Bob for a few weeks now from Sports Illustrated. None better. He just wrote the book this spring on Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson together. Bob, I just feel like it's time to do a deep dive on LIV versus PGA because it's so nasty, and this is the end of the PGA season this weekend. And so Bob will be with us on, you know, Tiger flew in for a meeting last week with 22 of the top players along with Rory McIlroy. So what is the PGA Tour going to do? Where is the LIV now? And could the LIV and the PGA just kind of get together and figure some things out? So we'll go in depth with Bob Herrig from Sports Illustrated, one of the very good guys. I met Bob through the late Pedro Gomez. You know, Pedro, of course, was part of the show for many, 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 many years, and we lost him a year ago, January. And Pedro said, you've got to get Bob Herrig on. This is when Bob was at ESPN, and always like seeing Bob on the other side of the Zoom. So that comes up here later on in the show. Opening comments brought to you by Desert Financial Credit Union. Desert Financial Credit Union, taking care of you, taking care of your business. That is Desert Financial Credit Union. As always, we appreciate their support. Off the top, Zach Alvira over at the Tribune did a story on my son today, our son. And it's really good. And it moved me in emotions this morning. I've talked about my son a little bit on this show in the past, on the surgeries and the adversity that he's faced. But he opened up about his mental health struggles in regards to PTSD of a car accident and fear and overcoming the fear and getting help. And Zach just did a really good job on it. It's in the East Valley Tribune today. You know, the picture of my wife and I and Cole is strong, but it's well done. I'll just put it at that. I really appreciate it. In terms of news of the day, so Kevin Durant, hey, it's August, but actually there's some tangible news today. So Kevin Durant and the Brooklyn Nets have come together. They're going to sing Kumbaya. Do I believe this? I don't know. It's August. They're going to open camp. He's off the market. He's not coming to the Suns. Suns are now in a space of, well, we'll turn our attention to somebody else. Of course you're going to turn your attention to somebody else. That's what you do. And I think in the long haul, Kevin Durant may come back on the radar screen again because you don't know. Nobody knows. You can say all you want. Oh, yeah, I am A-okay with everything that is going on here with Brooklyn in August. Yep, we put it behind us. I am just fine with that. And I look at it and say, you know, that all sounds well and good. We're going to move forward together. I'm pulling up his statement. So Nets general manager Sean Marks, Steve Nash and I together with Joe Tsai and Claire Wu TCI met with Kevin Durant and his agent in Los Angeles yesterday. We have agreed to move forward with our partnership. We are focusing on basketball with one collective goal in mind, build a lasting franchise to bring a championship to Brooklyn. Of course, just a month back, it's like, yeah, I don't want to be with Steve Nash or Sean Marks anymore. And so they have Ben Simmons over there. James Harden was there. I don't think the Suns needed the headache. I can make the argument, I've sat here and made the argument of, here's the argument as to what Kevin Durant would bring. Okay, so he's very familiar with Monty Williams. He's very familiar with Devin Booker from the Olympics. Chris Paul, all that stuff, that all sounds great. But here's why I've been on the side of, what are you thinking here? He's not been happy. He's been injured. He chose to go play with Kyrie over Steph Curry. Like, who would do that in this day and age? Seriously. And who's to say he wouldn't get here and be miserable and unhappy on top of it? So the more that this thing drug on, and then, you know, you see, you hear the price tag, and Mikal Bridges, Mikal Bridges has had some fun on Twitter the last few days. I don't sit here and scroll all day long. I have a life. I don't just sit here and scroll and scroll. I don't have notifications that go off all day and all night. But when I do spend the time and I see Mikal Bridges basically putting out there, he knows what's going on, that there's conversations and this and that, his name could be part of it. It's been fine. It's been funny. Do I think that the Suns can win the Western Conference? Here's the deal. As we sit here today on the 23rd of August, are the Suns a better franchise? Are they a better franchise today than they were at the end of the regular season? Have they done anything here in this offseason that makes you believe they are going to be that much better? And the answer would be no. The answer is they're going to run it back. That's what it looks like. Certainly what it looks like in October when camp opens. Which is my way of saying, just because Kevin Durant says this in August, it's like DeAndre Ayton saying, oh yeah, I'm good. It's fine to say it in July. Everybody's going to make me, they're on the same page. PR drives me crazy. Just, everything's great. Everything's fine. Let's go sell tickets. In reality, it's, okay, let's see where things are around, January 15th. Right around January 15th to January 30th. Let's see where things are. That's where I'm at on this. I don't for a second buy that the Suns have given up on Kevin Durant coming here. Don't buy that. It's not going to happen now because they're saying all the right things. I haven't for a second believed that DeAndre Ayton is going to be here 100% assuredly next April when the playoffs start. Guys will say all the PR stuff they want in the offseason. They do. And then the season gets started. The season's way too long. In October and November and December, there's games that you're just sitting there saying, why in God's green earth am I going to care about Cleveland on a Monday night against the Suns? And there just aren't that many huge, huge fans of the long NBA season. So on Christmas night, after all the packages are unwrapped, everybody's gone home, dinner's done, I'll probably watch the Suns against Denver. They're playing Christmas night. And I'll start paying a little bit of attention. I'll pay some attention to what's going on internally down there. You don't have to be there. You don't have to be at every game. You can see what's going on. And then we get into January, and you know, by the time the Super Bowl comes to town, leaves town, the focus will be, what are the Suns going to do at the trade deadline? Because assuming that health is good with the team, you're going to get into the, is Chris Paul going to wear down in the postseason? Is DeAndre really on the same page as Monty? I think for now, it's the next offseason for the Suns is going to be next January in season. The next time they can make a big acquisition will probably be late January, right around the deadline. And it wouldn't surprise me one bit if Kevin Durant circles back around on the radar screen if things don't go well. You can say all day long in August that you're going to be on the same page. I don't buy that for a minute. Don't buy it for a minute, but you know, they're going to try it. They're going to make a go of it. Really interesting story today out in California. A sports technology company, Kongik. I got to get that pronunciation down. So a sports technology company in California is offering NIL, name, image, likeness deal to entire high school. High school. We have told you that this is coming here in Arizona. David Hines spoke about it a couple weeks ago. Cannot have anything to do with the jersey of the high school player. There's parents that have moved their kids to California because they want NIL. It's happening. So now you have a high school offering, and St. John Bosco is the high school. Very nice, very affluent high school. Great. The deal is athletes who opt in, so you can, in your high school locker room, hey, you're a 15-year-old, you're just starting to go through puberty. You don't know what you're doing with football. You don't even know how to put your pads on right, but you can make money playing football. Athletes who opt in will be influencers on the company's website. Players who promote the brand will get two payments. They haven't disclosed the financial terms. Like the sophomore that doesn't even know how to put on his shoulder pads, never put on a pair of football pants, I'm going out for football because I'm going to make $50 or I'm going to make $100. By the way, there's a 1099 coming if it's north than $400. So all of that is now happening at a high school in California. And always what happens is things that start in one state go to another. Here in our state, player puts on their, I'll just say, Hamilton Husky uniform or their Bash of Bear uniform, their Castile Colt, their Brophy Prep. Violation, can't do that. Can't wear the wristband with the sponsor name during a game that is AIA. Can't do that. Illegal here by the AIA. Eventually, there'll be some daddy baller that's an attorney that'll challenge it, in my opinion. But fascinating story with St. John Bosco. The Diamondbacks are in Kansas City tonight. Cardinals have their last worthless preseason game this weekend. And it's kind of interesting that Baker Mayfield's going to start against Cleveland in game one at Carolina. But that's about it on the NFL side. All right, Jordan Spurgeon on the documentary that we started up last night, aired on our YouTube channel. It's on our homepage today if you've not checked it out, our latest installment on the Doc series, From ALS to Ashes. That is on the other side. And then Bob Herrig on the LIV versus the PGA. You want to hear both these interviews, that's next. All right, as promised, I want to have Jordan Spurgeon on the documentary. It is out. It aired last night on YouTube. It's on our YouTube channel. It's on the website. Tonight it'll be on Bally Sports Arizona following the Diamondbacks Kansas City game. ALS to Ashes, the Corey Nocta story documentary, Spurge together with Brandy Aguilar. And I wanted to have Jordan come on for a couple of minutes just to chop this up. When you first heard this story, what were your thoughts on it? And did it come to fruition the way that you wanted it to on the screen?
Yeah, I think this first started late May, maybe early June. You had gotten a call from Ron Wolfley about Corey, just saying, hey, I know this guy, he's battling this. He really wants to share his story. I think you guys should do something on it. So he dropped it in a group text with some of us on the team. And I saw it and I was like, that sounds really interesting. And at the time you were like coming up with a schedule for summer for different hosting things. So I saw I was hosting a show in early July and I figured, okay, let me talk to the family. Let me talk to Ron. And, you know, I can put together a little mini documentary. I thought that was all I had in me was maybe a 5-minute documentary. And then Ron, first off, like went to Amish country and disappeared for a bit. So I couldn't get him by that show. So I was already like, okay, well, that's off the table. And then I finally sat down with Corey and Kimberly, maybe 3 weeks or a month after you had told me about it, just kind of slowly talking to them and calling Corey on the phone and just kind of getting a story more before going to sit down with him. And when me and Brandy went to their house, I think we sat down for about an hour. We talked a little bit before the shoot. We talked a lot after the shoot with them. And we both kind of walked out and we're like, yeah, this is a full documentary. We don't know how long, but it's not some 5-minute, like short form, really in-depth story. It's a full documentary on just them, just the way Corey presented himself, the way Kimberly like showed how much support she had, the way they talked about their fire crew. I knew the fire department would be great. So that day, I think I called you and I think you could hear it in my voice that I was excited that there was a really good story to tell here and it wasn't going to be some 2-week thing that is 5 minutes. And so, yeah, we talked about it and I told you, give me till the end of August and we'll put it into a full documentary and see where it ends up. And here we are. It's like 2 months later now and it made it and it did what I think it was supposed to do, which was really share Corey's story and spread a little bit of awareness for ALS, which was really important.
How easy or difficult was it to get Corey to jump on board to talk about himself in something that looks like on the surface is not going to end well?
Yeah, it was actually really easy. I think that was part of the reason why Ron had called you. Corey was very much ready to do this. They even mentioned the other day when I went back to their house that they were looking to have just somebody put something together. So they had something for the kids and for their family when that time unfortunately does come and Corey's no longer here. And so when Ron had mentioned that and then I had gotten in contact with them, they were like, oh, this is great. We really want to do this and talk about it. Because one thing I got from him almost immediately from talking to him is he knows that what he's going through sucks, and he knows it's not going to be a happy ending, but he knows there's other people going through it, and he wants to, you know, spread that awareness and let other people know what's helping him. And it's not that he's necessarily slowing the disease. I mean, we can get more into that later, but doctor did say he is sort of a slower progressor. Mm-hmm. But the support system he has, I think, is the most important part, no matter what you're going through. I know cancer is a little bit different than ALS because people can beat cancer. In ALS, you can't. But when you have the support system, it helps you. And I think that was apparent. And he just wanted to showcase that like immediately. So he was all on board with just sharing his story with us.
How about you on putting this story together? Because you've had cancer within your family, right? Did this story hit you differently because of that?
I would say it would a little bit. I think I kind of got attached to it. Like I said, immediately when we left the house, I think me and Brandy sat outside the house for 20 minutes and I was already like attached and like seeing the vision. And so it hit kind of close to home. And like I mentioned, you know, cancer is a little bit different, but then even, you know, just talking to people about it, I, in the middle of this documentary, got to go on a family trip to kind of get away for a week out in Florida. It's kind of, you know, you want to see grandparents before, you know, their time comes as well. And so we had a big family trip with family from Boston and California and everywhere. We met there. Cool. And I didn't know that my step grandpa, he had four family members, his sisters, his mom, a brother and a cousin. They all died from ALS. And it was something that I would have never known or found out because no one talks about ALS. I've never talked about it. I knew it was Lou Gehrig's disease. And so this kind of brought that to the forefront. And so I've had so many conversations that's kind of just been eye-opening as to, you know, people that I know that have been affected. I honestly had no clue at all before this. And so I think that was really, really eye-opening.
ALS to Ashes, the Corey Nocta story documentary. It is up on the website. It's on our YouTube channel. It will be on Bally Sports all week. Jordan Spurgeon put it together along with Brandy Aguilar. Spurge joins us for a few minutes. Tell me about Kimberly going in and Kimberly during all of this and what you observed, the wife.
Yeah, she's very, very strong. I mean, she's a nurse, so she comes from that background of kind of understanding things. Her and Corey, this was something that we weren't able to fit into the doc. They knew each other in high school. They went to high school together. They're both Arizona natives. They both kind of went their separate ways. They weren't really like close or anything like that, but they knew of each other. And then they kind of reconvened after their own, you know, previous relationships with other people and having kids with other people. And they kind of met, I think she said in her story that was really funny. He said that she Facebook stalked him and that's how they kind of got together. She denies that a little bit, but, no, immediately she just was very much, you could tell, really the focal point of that household. She's taking care of everything. She does a lot of the paperwork for him. She's really keeping everything on check. She's being there for him. She's talking to the firefighters to help, you know, some certain surprises they plan for him and certain things like that, as well as still working. Like she's still working as a nurse, which is tiring and taxing as of itself. And then to have to deal with this and know that you're in your second long relationship like this. And, you know, it might not be something that lasts forever at this point. Like maybe you think it would when you get married. So I can tell it's very, very hard on her. But she really just shoulders it and embraces what it is. And like Corey said, they just both want to just, you know, soak up as much time as they can together and just enjoy the time they have. And I really respect that perspective that they've come during this together. Just the fact that they're willing to know what's going to happen, but still be able to just be present and enjoy what they do have.
A couple other questions. So the fire station where everybody's gathered and there's check presentations that are made and the firehouse is erupting with joy and emotion. I saw tears there. I was there that day off to the side. Putting that together, how did that work? You've got the Cardinals, you have Desert Financial, you have the Firefighters Union. I mean, you have all these people that are there to help them out because the bills have to be staggering. And Ron started his GoFundMe on this too. And just that day and putting that together.
Yeah, that day you had reached out to Brandy and I and said, hey, I met with Jeff Mishi, the president and CEO of Desert Financial, and told him about the story and they want to get involved with the Random Act of Kindness. What can we do? And so we ran through a few ideas. We thought, okay, maybe we bring Jeff to the house and, you know, bring the check and we just kind of surprise. And then I at that point, I had already gone to the fire station once to interview about six of the firefighters, and they fed me lunch and we hung out for 4 or 5 hours. So I already knew just how tight knit they were. I've always heard about it because my roommate's family, his dad, his brother, they're both firefighters out in California in Carlsbad and now Valley Center. So I've kind of heard of that culture before, but I've never really been in there and experienced it. And so I saw that culture. And so thinking on it more, when you mentioned that Desert Financial wanted to be involved, I go, we have to just surprise them at the fire station. So we got in contact with Courtney at Desert Financial, who was kind of their in charge of their random acts of kindness stuff. And so we met with her on a Zoom and she said, hey, we'd love to get the Cardinals involved too. And we're like, okay, cool. Like, let's do this. And they said, we're only going to do it if the Cardinals, you know, want to get financially involved. We don't want to just do the hoopla where Big Red shows up and we're just the Cardinals there and that's it. And so they talked to them, got them to get financially involved as well and bring out players and jerseys and all that stuff. So the next step from there was, I think it took me 3 days to confirm the date. Like we were told, okay, August 12th, 10 a.m. That's the time that Jeff can be there. Let's get it done that day. And I'm like, okay, how am I going to figure out how to tell Corey and Kim without that? So I called the Goodyear Fire Department, left a voicemail, like their corporate office or whatever. And then Matt Rainey, who's the battalion chief, and he's an interim whatever's higher up than that too right now. He called back and said, hey, like I played football with Corey and now we're in the Goodyear Fire Department together. Like I've been here a long time. We want to help. And he goes, what can I do? And I go, find a way to not lie necessarily, but get Corey to the fire station on the 12th at 10 a.m. With no explanation of what it is. And so I think he texted her and she said, oh, can I come for dinner? And he goes, nope, you have to be here at 10 a.m. Sorry, get here at 10. She's like, okay. She canceled plans and they got there. And then, yeah. And then we kind of planned it out when we got there and everybody was there like an hour before Corey and Kim just organizing things. And yeah. And then you'll see in the documentary, they come out the car and just walk in and it was just
it's very emotional.
Yeah. Overflow.
Yeah. There was just emotion running all over it. You went down the path of education on ALS. As you said earlier, it's not something people know about. There were some parts of this, from my understanding in talking with Brandy, and I haven't talked to you about it yet. I'll just do it here. You guys learned a lot. There are some trials. There's some things behind the scenes. Fill me in on that.
Yeah. When we talked to Dr. Levine, who's one of the head ALS researchers and physicians or doctors here, in Arizona, he had a lot to say about kind of what they're doing. So a lot of it's trial runs. They're figuring out different things. So we didn't really include that in the documentary. It just wasn't the right place. But if you head over to the website, we also wrote an article to go with this. And at the bottom, we wrote a sidebar. Brandy actually wrote the sidebar and we called it Finding a Cure. And it basically just explains a little bit like the biggest breakthrough, quote unquote, they found. And even he said it's not much of a breakthrough, but it could be something, was that they're finding that there is a gene that potentially causes ALS in a certain amount of people. And so it's a genetic thing almost. And so they're running an 8-year test where they're basically finding healthy people that have had family members with ALS. They test for the gene, they have the gene, and then they're shutting it off and seeing if that person will still end up with ALS years down the road. And so they're in the middle of that, which medically is honestly above like what I can handle, but it sounds promising. And the way Dr. Levine told us about it, it seems like that's something where it's still not going to give a cure for ALS and they don't know when they'll get it because they still don't know exactly what causes it beyond that gene in certain people. But that test is something that they're working hard on to see if they can, you know, find a way to get some answers for at least some people with ALS by preventing it before it happens.
That's great. That's great. You tied that in. What's next?
What's next?
What's next? Do you have another doc in you? Does this make you want to do more docs? I mean, sometimes people just need to get away and sometimes you just fall into them. Where's this at for you?
Yeah, I definitely think I have more docs in me. I think this is now 1 year to the day of the first doc I worked on, the Zach Hoffpower doc, I think aired August 23rd last year. So this literally ended up being a year apart.
Yeah.
And both times it's been so rewarding. It's very tiring. I mean, I was talking to Brandy about this last night. It's the last 2 or 3 weeks, even when you're not working on it and you're doing something else, it's on your mind like 95% of the time. Like it's just your brain is firing on all cylinders nonstop. But I really enjoy it because it's rewarding. I mean, I know we talk about this and there's a place for August sports, especially out here where you're talking about backup defensive linemen and, you know, walk-ons at ASU or U of Arizona. And, you know, those are all great and fans care about that. But I'd rather spend my mental capacity at this point in the year on something like this. And so I definitely think this might become a yearly thing. I mean, when this doc came, I kind of figured there wasn't one this year. Sometimes they just kind of need to fall in your lap. And all of a sudden, when I kind of had given up on that and was kind of planning some other stuff for summer, it was, oh, here's a doc right on your desk. Let's get after this and do it. So there's definitely more. But until then, it's get away for a bit. I might try to go up north for a little bit this week and then get ready for football season. It'll be a different animal.
It's good stuff. Great work. Good job. Well done. And all the platitudes. You guys crushed it. ALS to Ashes, the Corey Nocta story documentary. Jordan Spurgeon was the executive producer of it. Brandy Aguilar right alongside him, the two of them doing terrific work. It's up on the website. It is on our YouTube channel. It will be on Bally Sports Arizona. It is airing now. Good seeing you.
Thanks, Brad. You too.
We're back with more after this timeout. All right, as promised, let's do a deeper dive into what has gone on this year on the PGA Tour with the LIV coming on board, summing it up in only the way that he can as Sports Illustrated's Bob Herrig. Good to have Bob back, of course, the author of Tiger versus Phil, Golf's Most Fascinating Rivalry. Tour wrap this week at East Lake Golf Club in Atlanta. How would you sum up this year if we're just talking golf, Bob?
Well, it's probably the most seen in some time. I mean, I'd probably have to go back to the height of Tiger when, you know, you had the Tiger lovers and you had the Tiger haters because they thought he was winning too much or what have you. And a lot of people didn't like him necessarily. A lot of people loved him. With the LIV thing, you've got very passionate feelings on both sides. I mean, it's amazing how many people are mad that anybody would question that LIV would try to do this. Obviously the PGA Tour doesn't want them to do this. And yet there's this segment of people who's now trashing the PGA Tour. And I'm not saying the PGA Tour has done everything right, certainly. You know, they've been pretty darn successful for a long time. And it's hard to blame them for wanting to sort of, you know, keep what they've had. Yet on the other side, the LIV folks, guaranteed money. We've never seen that in golf. You know, smaller fields, which is, you know, believed to be good for TV. Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure the shotgun start idea is great. I'm having a hard time adjusting to it. I've been to all three of their events so far. It's here and it's controversial and I don't think it's going away.
Let's go with the key players here and just Moynihan versus Norman. How much hatred? This is not Brooks versus Bryson. This is like times 100, right?
Correct. I mean, you know, I don't know if there's any personal animosity between them. I don't know how much they know each other, to be honest with you. I mean, you know, Norman's sort of been out of the game, so to speak, other than hosting the what used to be called the Shark Shootout. I don't think he'll be at that event this fall in Naples, Florida. But I mean, Norman's animosity goes way back when Tim Finchem was the commissioner in the early 90s. Norman, he tried to start a world tour similar to this, small fields, guaranteed money. And basically, Finchem kind of rallied people around him and squashed it. And then later came up with the World Golf Championship idea, which Norman felt like, you know, that's what I wanted to do. Of course, the tour wanted to try to do this within his parameters and has chosen not to. But Norman actually has a point going back a long time, which is when he was a top player, he was in demand and he could go get appearance fees by playing in Europe or going to his home country of Australia. And every time he wanted to do that, he essentially had to ask for permission. He had to ask for release. That's the rules. But you're only given three. Well, Norman might play two events in Europe. He was a very, very popular guy. He had every right to try to cash in, right? As long as he was fulfilling his PGA Tour obligations. At the time, whenever he'd go back to Australia in our winter months, the summer down there, he'd want to play three or four times. He'd have to get releases for all of them. Well, because he would go beyond the three, the tour would extract favors from him to give him more. And he resented that. They would say, okay, we'll give you two extra, but you need to go play Milwaukee, say, or Phoenix, or someplace where he hadn't been playing. Or we need you to go there two of the next 3 years. And if he wanted to play the Australia event, he had no choice. He had to agree, or they wouldn't. They wouldn't allow it. They owned his media rights. They had those are the rules, and he thought that was wrong. Now the tour has since changed that for a home tour. A guy like Rory McIlroy, whose home tour is the European Tour, the DP World Tour, he can play unlimited in continental Europe or you know, the UK and Ireland. But he must play the 15 on the PGA Tour. Mm-hmm. If he wants to go to the Middle East, if he wants to go to Japan outside the PGA Tour, if he wants to go to Australia, he has to get a release. He's allowed three. If he goes beyond that, he's going to have to do something. And Norman has always felt 30 years that that's wrong, that as long as I play my 15, I should be able to do whatever I want. And that's sort of the root of this too, the ability to play when you want and where you want. And also I maintain guaranteed money. You know, golfers show up. Look at the crowds at the Waste Management Tournament, the huge crowds. Okay. They're selling tickets from dawn until dusk. They have a pretty good crowd probably for the Pro-Am as well on Wednesday. Yep. You're going to play in the Pro-Am in 2 days. And if you miss the cut, you get zero, but yet you're part of the show. So like, I kind of get that part of this. You know, we don't have to necessarily like the live idea. And certainly the funding is hugely controversial. We haven't even talked about that. But why we got here is, I think, important for people to understand. You know, the tour hasn't done everything perfectly. The players probably do have some legitimate gripes. And now trying to figure that out and come to some understanding is proving to be a challenge.
Bob Herrig, Sports Illustrated, with us for a few minutes. And to that end, I want to advance it to just this last week at the BMW. You have Tiger flying in and Rory in a room. That story, from your view, what stood out to you most? What came out of that? Just the whole setting of Tiger standing in there saying, look, we got to do something here, and here's what we're going to do.
Well, first, just Tiger taking such an out front role like that. I think that's, you know, that's instructive. I mean, that's not been Tiger throughout most of his career. He's sort of been a lone wolf. As he's gotten older, he's taken on more of a leadership role with the Ryder Cup and the President's Cup. He's been very out front with that behind the scenes, mostly. And if he's tried to throw his weight around with the tour, he's done it behind the scenes. This is sort of the signal that he's not behind the scenes, even though he's not talking to us personally. The fact that he would show up there and we're all going to know about it is sort of an indication. So that's one thing. And then, you know, there's been some tidbits that have trickled out. I wrote about it over the weekend. I'm not convinced what I heard is necessarily the final thing they want to do, but they threw out these ideas of these 60 player fields with no cut and $20 million purses and, you know, as many as 18 of them. I think that's unrealistic. I don't know how you do that, but 10 or 12 might make sense, you know, and if you're talking about those outside of the Players Championship and the majors and the playoff events, now you are bringing the top players together more often. Of course, it's sort of goes against their argument that no cut events aren't as competitive, which is what LIV is doing and what they're complaining about.
There's a lot of Bob. There's a lot of LIV in what came out over the weekend, isn't there? I mean, you look at it and say there's some stuff from LIV here that Tiger is trying to bring in, right? Am I missing that?
No, you're right. In a sense, that's true. Limited field, 60 players is more than 48, obviously. Four rounds is more than three. I don't think they're talking about shotgun starts, and there's no team thing they're talking about like LIV is doing. But, you know, 18 of them, LIV is going to do 14. You know, no matter what side of this you're on, like if LIV wanted to get set in the beginning they wanted to do, You can't play 14 events. You can't play 18. You have to play a smaller number. So because in theory, you'd be then any PGA Tour player would be available to it. Well, what about the rest of the tour? 14 of those plus the majors, plus the players, plus the playoff events. you're getting into territory where these guys don't play that much. So if you frankly, the team concept, which is being bashed and sort of ridiculed because they've got these funky names that nobody knows.
Right.
You know, but yet there is some value to that if you did it, if you didn't have so many. Like if you did that under the PGA Tour banner and you had like six of these tournaments, say, six of these 48 player tournaments, and you did them once a month, and then you had like a big team championship after the tour championship a couple weeks later, say, that could, I think that could have some traction. You know, if you had Rory and I don't know, if you did it by country even and had guys on different teams, and you know, that might, and again, look, I'm just throwing that out there. I might sit in a room, we kick this around and they all say, well, this is ridiculous. There's no way that could work. Okay. Well, can't we at least talk about it? You know, I mean, golf could use some alternate formats.
Okay. So you're talking about 14 and 18. Couldn't you make it 15 and 15? And what if you had Liv compete twice a year against PGA?
Yeah.
People would watch. There would be hatred. There would be a lot of angst. There'd be a lot of interest in Liv V. Because right now, we're not going to see the best of the best every week.
And that's
things are gone.
Exactly. And I think that's what's bad for the game.
Right.
I really think that's bad for the game. And so, you know, the idea of them somehow working something out, which seems ludicrous at this point, actually could make some sense. You know, that way the PGA Tour gets its players back. Cam Smith is reported going, okay? Right. You know, I've tried to stay away from this, but all the indications are that he's going after the Tour Championship. Does the PGA Tour not want him to defend the Players' Championship next year? Do they not want the Open champion playing in PGA Tour events? Well, if you lowered the number of live events, if you lowered the requirement of tournaments to play in the PGA Tour for these guys, you could work something out. The tour could benefit financially from it, because if Liv gets a TV deal, say it had 10 events and NBC decided to cover it and paid them, the tour would rightfully deserve a cut of it. That they have the media rights to their players. Mm-hmm. They could. Liv has so much money, the tour could say, look, every time you play a tournament, you subsidize the purse of the tournament going opposite on the PGA Tour. How about you kick in $3 million? Well, now all of a sudden the John Deere, and I'm just throwing the John Deere out there because the Portland event went up against John Deere. John Deere's purse was like $7 million this year. Give them, now it's $10 million, and everybody who's not in Liv goes and plays there. All of a sudden that tournament's enhanced too. At least they're playing for more money. I mean, I'm just kind of spitballing this.
Yeah,
and there's already a few ideas that might make some sense. So like some smarter people could get in a room and figure this out. And maybe you don't have, you know, maybe there's still going to be some ill will, but the gain for Liv is, okay, now maybe Rory comes and plays with them. Maybe Zalatoris, maybe Scottie Scheffler. Maybe you get 30 of the top 50 in the world who do that. They give them some guaranteed money up front. They play all 10 of their events. But now those guys are still free to play the Genesis, the Arnold Palmer, the Memorial, the Players, the playoff events. You could still have a FedEx Cup, but the Liv stuff wouldn't count toward it. So they'd have to make a decision, because you're going to go for a lot of money, but you're not going to be earning FedEx points like everybody else is. I don't know. I just think smarter heads get together and maybe can figure out a way to make this work.
Yeah, or a lot of lawyers are going to get together.
No question. Or, you know, what's going to happen most likely, I'm guessing my little pie in the sky thing here isn't going to fly. They're going to stay separate and guys will continue to bleed over there. There's going to be five or six that are supposedly going next week. Then there might be a couple more before the start of next year. Then they'll be locked in with their 48 in 2023. And then as that season wears on, they'll recruit a few more guys for 2023. And then the tour has this slow bleed. I mean, for the tour is it creates opportunity for other guys to make a name for themselves. I mean, we saw it from player Tom Kim, his American first name, Tom. I believe it's Jung Yul Kim. Yeah, he's 20 years old. And he's like, you know, he's like in the top 30 in the world already. He narrowly missed the tour championship. And he overcame a quadruple bogey on the first hole and went on to win the tournament. Very nice young player. Well-spoken, great maturity, great sense of humor, that's an opportunity. Now, maybe there could be more of those. But I still think, don't we want to see Brooks and Bryson and Dustin Johnson playing against, you know, Rory and Zalatoris and these guys? We won't see that until the Masters.
Yeah. No, I just wanted to get you in on a deep dive on it because it is so interesting from so many angles. And even though, you know, we're looking at Scheffler and Cantlay coming into this weekend to finish it up, put a bow on it, everybody's talking about the LIV and the PGA, and they're not talking much at all about what's going on the course, which ultimately I think hurts the game. But I appreciate your time and your insight as always, Bob. Stay safe. Thanks.
Thank you, Brad. Appreciate you having me.
Bob Herrig there, Sports Illustrated, and we're back with more after this timeout.